from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made on the streets of just about every American city. Somewhere, someone just called police because a black man was walking past a store or in a mall or past their house. Whether it's Rochester, Philadelphia, St. Louis, wherever. And if you don't believe me, just ask Gerald Early, an author, essayist, professor, and cultural critic. He's one of the most diversely talented writers and analysts in the country today. He's consulted with documentary filmmaker Ken Burns on baseball, jazz, and a film called Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. He writes on literature, the Korean War, and a great deal more. And Thursday, Gerald Early is coming to the University of Rochester to celebrate the opening of the new Humanities Center. He happens to be the founding director of the Humanities Center at Washington University in St. Louis, where he's been a professor of modern letters, English, African, and Afro-American studies, and he's my guest for the first half hour today on Connections. Gerald Early, thanks for taking the time to join us. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
And also with me in studio is Joan Rubin, a history professor and the interim director of the new Humanities Center at the University of Rochester. Congratulations for this great week for the university. And how are you, Joan?
I'm fine, and I'm delighted to be here. Thanks.
Well, Gerald Early is going to be here Thursday, 5 p.m., for an event at the Hawkins Carlson Room at Rush Reese Library. Free event, Joan?
It's a free event. There's even free parking. We welcome the public to attend.
All right. That's at 5 p.m. on Thursday. And Gerald, this is a time in the country where we've had a lot of people asking, you know, what do cultural critics think about what's been going on for the last couple of years? I've seen a couple of clips online of you talking about your own experience of sort of being profiled in the early 1990s. And it's just really remarkable to hear these kinds of stories that they are real, but they are. Can you talk about your experience?
This happened in the early 1990s in a small suburban city called Frontenac, which is right outside St. Louis. I was, it's a very upscale community, and I was at a shopping mall there. I was waiting for my wife, who had gone to a Junior League Christmas event. At that time, my wife was a member of the Junior League, and she had taken our two daughters with her. And I was walking up and down this mall, and one of the owners of one of the stores in the mall, this is a very upscale mall, called the police saying there was a suspicious-looking black man walking around the mall. And so the cops came and asked me for identification and why I was there and all this. And it just so happens at the time that this happened, my wife and our kids came out. And also several other people who were part of this Junior League event came out. So it was a strange and fairly humiliating experience. And so after it happened, my wife was very upset with this, and she went to the chief of police in Frontenac and wanted an apology for what happened, and he refused to give an apology. In fact, he was quite rude to her. And this set in motion a kind of chain of events that eventually the story wound up in the New York Times about African-American couple in suburban St. Louis town demands apology for racial profiling and all this. And, you know, finally we got a meeting with the mayor of Frontenac, and he did issue an apology. I mean, he didn't want to, but he did eventually issue an apology to us.
You were approached by police essentially because you were in a mall walking while black. Fair, that's an accurate description, isn't it?
That's an accurate description. I wasn't doing anything. I was just walking up and down this mall, passing time. There were lots of white people walking up and down this mall. I happened to be the only black person who was walking up and down this mall.
And by the way, Gerald, did the store owners tell police why they were concerned? They thought you were going to rob them? I mean, I'm trying to.
Yes, they did.
They did.
The store owner thought it was the person who called the police owned it was a jewelry store in this mall, and it was the person who owned this jewelry store who called the police. And right, he told the police that he thought I was going to rob his store, and he had a white female clerk in the store who was nervous about leaving the store and going to her car because this black man was walking up and down the mall. That's exactly what happened.
Amazing. And this is the early 1990s. Well, just today I see a headline in a new study. Stanford researchers found that on an individual level, whites do not think that privilege extends to them, that many white people will acknowledge white privilege, but then when they're asked specific questions, they don't think it impacted their own lives or their own success. And the researchers found that whites exposed to evidence of racial privilege respond by claiming that their own personal hardships were a bigger factor than perhaps there were. So those surveyed didn't deny the existence of racial privilege held by whites as a group. They just came up with other reasons, namely personal obstacles in their own life, why they should be considered differently from the overall group. And, you know, Gerald, your story of the way you were profiled in that mall should remind all of us who are listening, if for all of our white listeners, myself included, that's never happened to me. And right now in this country, we are talking about the experience of our fellow Americans. And I think these are the moments where we have to understand what these things mean. What have you made of the conversation we're having as a nation in the last couple of years?
Well, I think it's been a very interesting and I'm not sure if it's cleared the air about things, but I think it's been a very interesting conversation that's been going on in the last few years. I certainly do think that having elected an African-American president has brought certain kind of issues to light or given a kind of focus to certain kinds of things which might not have happened had we not elected an African-American president. I think certain kind of political views have become even more polarized or racialized because we've elected an African-American president. I think that has also sharpened or intensified racial views in the United States in the last few years. As you know, I am from St. Louis, I live only about 5 or 6 miles from Ferguson, which last year, you know, had this enormous unrest as a result of a young black man being shot to death by the police in Ferguson, and yeah, it was quite a shocking event to all of us in St. Louis, simply because St. Louis has always been a city where there's been a lot of racial tension and unrest below the surface, but I think it shocked everyone here, both black and white, when the amount of violence that happened. No one expected it. It seems many people, both black and white here, thought it was out of character, but I think it was part of just the overall enormous sense of tension over racial issues that exist now in the country.
And here's where I don't know how to sort of be constructive about this. And I guess what I mean by that, Gerald, is that, you know, on this program, we try to champion opening our minds, learning new things, maybe changing our positions at times. But there are some people in this country who don't think white privilege is real, or they have a kind of a visceral reaction when you hear stories about people, unfortunately, people like yourself in those instances where you get profiled simply because of your race, you get treated differently. And I don't know how to change what seems to be intractable in some people. And not that they'll have to think like I do. I mean, I'm certainly evolving in my own thinking, I hope, every day. But how do we have a conversation that is productive, Gerald, that doesn't seek to make a monolithic thought process, but allows us to see the differences, to see the advantages and disadvantages, and then maybe to respond to them? I don't know how we get there. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's a difficult process. I've been involved with lots of dialogue sessions in St. Louis. I've talked to many mixed racial groups, many white groups, and it's very difficult. Number one, most whites, when they have to deal with racial issues, one common reaction, which I think is a very human reaction, is to become defensive because people don't want to hear bad things about themselves. It's just natural that you don't want people to say, oh, you know, not you personally, but your group has done this, or your group has taken advantage of this or something like that. And, you know, most people are human. They don't they think well of themselves, they think they're decent people, they individualize it, and they say, oh, that's not me, you know, just as what you were saying before, that, no, that's not me. I mean, I don't take advantage of white privilege or things like this. And so trying to get people, when I'm trying to have a conversation, especially with mixed race, a mixed audience of blacks and whites, you're trying to get whites over this idea of being defensive about this. You're also trying to get African-Americans in the audience over the tendency to want to be accusative or just wanting to sort of vent. And so you're trying to get people, you're trying to get whites over trying to duck the blame, and you're trying to get African-Americans over just being angry and venting their anger. This is extremely difficult to do because it's human nature. If you feel you've been victimized, to want to be angry and to want to vent your anger at the people you feel have victimized you, and it's human nature for people when someone comes at you and they're angry and they're accusing you of something to be defensive and to say, I didn't do that. And to get people over that, over those things, very difficult. It takes a lot of patience, and it takes a lot of working with people to get them to realize that those responses are non-productive responses, and you're never going to get anywhere as long as you keep responding that way.
Talking to Gerald Early, who is coming to the University of Rochester on Thursday, 5 p.m. He is giving a presentation in the Hawkins Carlson Room of Rush Reese Library as the University of Rochester opens their new Humanities Center. And he's my guest for this half hour on Connections. And if you want to call the program or join the conversation, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. In a minute, I'm just going to ask Gerald to kind of give us a brief preview of some of the work he's been doing and some of the conversation he's going to have on Thursday. But let me just get a couple questions that have already come in. Gary writes to the program in regards to that awful story of what happened to Gerald in the early 1990s in a mall in suburban St. Louis. Gary says, I certainly understand the issue, but why the police apology? They are committed to respond. An apology from the complainants should have been made, but why the police, Gerald?
Well, at first, we went to the police because we had no idea who made the complaint. We didn't find out, actually, who made the complaint until almost at the end of the process. And actually, my wife went to the police not so much at first for an apology as it was to just get an explanation as to why this happened to someone who wasn't doing anything. I mean, why did it happen? Why were the police called? And so forth. And I think it was because the police chief was so rude and nasty about this whole thing and being questioned about this whole thing, and kept telling her things like, oh, well, you know, we have to watch out for blacks who come into Frontenac because, you know, they commit a lot of crime and stuff like that, and we have to be careful about this sort of thing. That I think that's what really propelled this thing about asking for an apology from the police. And also because once it hit the newspapers framed it that way. And so at that point, we were kind of on a track, you could say, moving in that particular direction. But it didn't start off specifically for an apology from the police as much as it was an explanation from the police.
And Jake writes to the program, what was that study you mentioned earlier about the perception of white privilege? A friend of mine responded in exactly the manner you described. It was alarming as I tried to break down the Black Lives Matter movement to her, and she absolutely refused to see her own deflecting behavior. Jake, it's a new study out of Stanford by researchers L. Taylor Phillips and Brian Lowry, and you can check it out. There are headlines on it today. And again, what the Stanford researchers found was that that whites as a group say, sure, white privilege is real, but individually they come up with their own reasons for why they sort of pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. Here's a quote from the researcher, quote, you like to have nice things, but you don't want to think that you got those things as a result of unearned advantages. So you come up with other reasons, namely personal obstacles, to explain why you are different than the group. That's a study out today. And Jake, I hope that helps there. Gerald Early, what do you make of, you know, again, this is such a broad question that I can't ask you. What do you think of the Black Black Lives Matter movement. But let me be more specific. On this program recently, we talked about Hillary Clinton's comments to the Boston chapter of the Black Lives Matter movement, in which she said, you need an agenda, that really movements don't accomplish things without a listed set of goals. You need an agenda. You need to be more organized. So on this program, some in the Rochester area kind of debated that. Some said, hey, it's not up to us to tell non-black people how to treat people humanely. And others said, she's right. We need an agenda. We need to be more organized. Does there need to be more organization on this?
Yeah, well, there probably does need to be more organization on this. I mean, this is a movement that kind of came up, sort of sprung up kind of spontaneously as a result of Ferguson. I mean, Ferguson was really sort of like the ground zero for it. It was, people in St. Louis can say they were sort of present at the creation of it. And so, yeah, I mean, it came up out of a kind of oppositional kind of energy and unhappiness and an intense emotion as to what happened in Ferguson. And so, sure, if it's going to be a serious political movement, and certainly if it's going to have any intention of sustaining itself, yes, it will have to at some point really become a great deal more strategic about what it's doing, because just the act of civil disobedience and going out and stopping traffic on highways and things like that will gather you some attention, but it's certainly not a long-term political strategy that can really affect change in a profound or lasting way. So, yeah, that's true. On the other hand, it should be remembered that, many political movements, if not most political movements that are going up against, a hegemonic or, established power, most of them start out with people being kind of spontaneous and emotional and starting out just because they're disgusted and upset by a particular thing that happens, and it goes through kind of stages. And so the Black Lives Matter movement, I'm sure, will go through these stages as well. And the young people who are creating this movement, I'm sure they've already been told by many other people who've talked to them about the need for more strategy, but certainly the need for the fact that they came from emotional basis and so forth is important as well, just to get people active. There were a lot of African Americans who were just impressed that Black Lives Matter started, and that there were people out there who were just this upset about it, that they were willing to go through these acts of civil disobedience to demonstrate their unhappiness, because this, believe me, this unhappiness about being mistreated by the police and so forth, has festered among African Americans for decades. I mean, it's just been an intense amount of unhappiness about it.
My time with Gerald Early is going to evaporate before I can get through roughly half of what I wanted to talk about, but that just means that our listeners can come out and see him on Thursday at 5 p.m. at the University of Rochester for his presentation, which my understanding, Gerald, is going to focus at least in part on the research you've been doing on the African community in Philadelphia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm a native of Philadelphia. I was born and I grew up there, and I have always had a longstanding, and most of my family still lives in Philadelphia, so I go to Philadelphia frequently, and I have a very, I've been for a long time quite interested in an African-American festival that takes place in Philadelphia and the impact that this festival has had on the neighborhood in which it takes place. And so that's what the focus of my talk will be. It's about this festival and the racial impact that this festival has had, because the festival is taking place in basically a gentrified community. And so the story about this, I think, is a very interesting one about urban politics and about battles for space in urban communities.
Gentrification and related questions, every community is different, every city is different, but there are related questions. We have a poverty report here in Rochester. We are the most impoverished city of our roughly this size in the country, with about 56% of Rochester kids growing up in poverty, mm-hmm. and extreme poverty at an alarming rate here. So, you've been working and studying Philadelphia. I know you've been around the country. I'm sure there are parallels, I guess is what I'm trying to say, Gerald, from the work that you're doing there. Every city is different, but I would guess there are parallels and lessons to be learned here.
Oh, I think so. I think that there are certain, I mean, the story of, you know, the battle over urban spaces, over gentrification, over urban poverty, they're different, you know, there may be a different set of chords in the composition in different cities, but the tune is basically the same. And I do think that when I'm presenting to people the kind of case study with this, with what's going on with this African-American festival in Philadelphia, but I do believe that people will, in Rochester or people in St. Louis or people in San Francisco can hear this account and very much recognize their own city and very much recognize there are certain just common problems and common issues involved in what I call the divided city.
Joel writes to us in regards to the question on the Black Lives Matter movement. Power yields nothing without a demand, said Frederick Douglass. So assuming that's an accurate quote, and Joel's a smart guy, that's a good echo of history there on the question of whether movements need agendas. Let me try to sneak in a phone call here, and Sheila in Rochester. Go ahead, Sheila. Sheila, go ahead. We don't have her. Sheila, call back if you can. We're going to continue the conversation in our second half hour. Just a few more minutes with Gerald Early. And Gerald, you know, you're talking about, you're here to talk at the opening of the Humanities Center. And I'd be remiss if I didn't at least ask on the question of the humanities. I mean, you're someone who writes and studies and reads and helps commentate on such a broad range of subjects, some of them a lot more enjoyable to discuss, I'm sure, than unfortunately some of the subjects that have dominated the conversation recently. But every few months, we've got a conversation in this country or an article written that the humanities are dead, that all the students, if you want to make money, you better get into STEM. There's no money in the humanities. And we've talked about that on this program as well. But what do you make of all of those commentaries that you read about the death of the humanities?
Well, you know, I think the death of the humanities have been, you know, to borrow a phrase here, rather greatly exaggerated. I think that humanities are always going to be here. I think that the humanities are essential to human life because the humanities is essentially about a major human impulse, and that is the impulse to find meaning in what we do. That's really what the humanities, to find meaning in what we do and to understand the symbols and art that we create to parse out and symbolize and narrativize our experience. So, you know, there isn't any getting away from the humanities in that regard. They're essential to human life. Human beings can't function without the humanities. They wouldn't even know how to construct reality without the humanities. I mean, the humanities are the frame through which human beings make their reality. So that's not a question. Now, the question about, you know, the commercial viability of the humanities or things like that, that's another set of questions, but that's involving a particular value lens that people are throwing on knowledge and schooling. And, you know, to say that, you know, these things are more valuable than these other things because in our culture we pay more for them or there are more job demands for them and the like. And that, I wouldn't dispute that. I'm sure that's very much true. But that's placing a wrong kind of value on the humanities. The humanities is something that part of the human equipment. You can't, you know, there's no need to talk about its value in that sense. It doesn't make a lot of, it's not very practical to attach value to the humanities based on our understanding of how you get a job, because the humanities is really something that transcends the whole business of getting a job. It's about how human beings construct reality, and there are always going to be people who are interested in it. People are always going to do humanities. Now, whether it's going to pay well to do it is another story, but people are always going to do it. Well, no matter what it pays, people are going to do it because they can't help but do it because it's part of who we are.
All right, last quick question, and it comes from a listener. Tim in Pittsford, who is one of the thoughtful regular listeners of this program, just responded to some of the conversation he heard earlier. He says, I understand what that Stanford study is saying, but am I supposed to feel bad for where I am in life? Am I supposed to try and make amends for being white? I'm just confused on what I should do. I don't deflect. As you know, I've said before, there's no part of my life that sucks because I'm white. I try to be a good person, but I can't change my race, and I'm proud of where I come from, just like a black person should be proud of where they come from. That's Tim in Pittsford. Gerald, what do you think?
Well, it's fine what he said. I think it's not very useful for whites to feel guilty. I don't think it's very useful for them to feel defensive. We live in a civil society. You live in a society with lots of other people. You live in a society that's unequal. You live in a society where people have had a history of persecution and the like. What all of us have to do jointly is figure out ways of making the society more equitable and figuring out ways that we can all construct a past that we can all live with and understand and respect one another. And that's really what it's about. And guilt's not going to get us there. Anger's not, because if guilt and anger were going to get us to the endpoints where we want to get to as a mature civil society, it would have done so already, because there's been plenty of guilt and plenty of anger. So obviously those are not the ways we're going to get there. But certainly, we need to have mature thinking, and we need to understand that society is, you live in a society with many other people, and it's a growing process, and we have to work through our tensions.
Gerald, I look forward to more of the conversation that you're going to help lead on Thursday. It's at 5 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library's Hawkins Carlson Room at the University of Rochester, part of their celebration of opening the new Humanity Center. That is a free event, and Gerald Early is going to be here for that. He has such a distinguished background. I couldn't fit it all into one line. Author, essayist, professor, cultural critic, consultant on Ken Burns films. I mean, I'm probably doing you a disservice by trying to list everything you've done, Gerald. But thank you for taking the time for us on this program, and we will see you here on Thursday.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, we're going to take a short break, come back with Joan Rubin, who is the interim director of the new Humanity Center. And we're going to talk humanities, the value of the humanities that you heard Gerald just touching on there. That is next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, I stand with Ahmed. We know the story of the young Muslim boy who brought the clock to school in Texas. We're going to talk to young local Muslims about the experiences they've had growing up in the Rochester area. Then second hour, the story of the hedge fund manager who raised the price of a life-saving drug from $13 a pill to $750. Is that the future of medicine? Talk to you Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Villa of Hope, offering trauma-informed care for youth and families in the greater Rochester area that are struggling with chemical dependency, mental illness, poverty, and neglect. More at villaofhope.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and my guest for the rest of the hour is Joan Rubin, who is a history professor, the interim director of the new Humanity Center at the University of Rochester. And I know you're excited for Thursday. What do you make of what you just heard with Professor Early?
Oh, I was thrilled. I have not actually had a chance to meet him yet, and I'm now so looking forward to his visit, and I hope that your listeners will come out and have a chance to see him in person, because I thought he was fantastic.
He's a very dynamic speaker, and again, if you're just joining us, this is a guy who could speak at length on the history of jazz, African Americans and jazz, literature from fiction to nonfiction, and the value of each, humanities. He's publishing a journal. He's doing all of these things, and I tried to move through as much territory as I could. But again, with the way this country is sort of working through some of these racial tensions now, I had to start with his history. And Joan, I don't know if you knew about that story about him in the early 1990s, about how he was in a mall with his family, and white store owner said, hey, there's a black guy in the mall, called police and said they were worried he was going to rob them.
Right.
He was not arrested, but he was essentially questioned by police after he was called by informed by shop owners for being black in a mall.
Right.
What did you think?
Well, I had not heard that story before, and it's incredibly powerful. As you said, his only deed was walking while black. The only thing he did was walk through there, and be who he was, and so we. have a lot to think about and work through, as he said.
And, you know, he also made a very interesting point. A lot of the conventional wisdom in 2008, 2009 was, well, hey, we elected a black president, first black president, and we are in a more healed place. Now, I know some people said, well, now we're in a post-racial society, which was always a silly thing to say, but the idea was that we were more healed. And Gerald Early is saying that we've exposed more of the animus, that it's almost more tense and more sharp. And I found that interesting as well. I look forward to him talking more about that. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think he's right. And he is going to speak about this case study of Philadelphia, where he has spent a lot of his life. And what will be interesting to me especially will be to see how he uses his perspectives as a cultural critic, an observer, something of a historian, to raise questions that are very much pertinent to what we're dealing with today.
Listeners, we've had this conversation in the past about whether we still need the humanities. And of course we do. I mean, this is a biased host here. Yes, of course we do. But, you know, if you're someone with a background of the humanities or you studied it, et cetera, I always love to hear your stories and how it has impacted your life and your work. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. At Evan Dawson on Twitter or edawson@wxxi.org. How has studying the humanities impacted your life? And the reason that Gerald Early is talking about the humanities is he happens to be one of the co-founders and director of the Humanities Center where he works at Washington University in St. Louis. University of Rochester is opening its Humanities Center. And Joan, you know, give me a sense for why the University of Rochester said, let's do this. This is the right time for this.
Right. Well, this was an initiative that bubbled up from the faculty in some ways. Those of us who work as scholars of the humanities, and we include history and anthropology in a rather capacious definition of the humanities, by the way, wanted to create a kind of hub where we could have some sense of community. Now, at the U of R, this is particularly important because we have such excellent faculty in the sciences. And so, for better or worse, we are often known as a science school. And yet we have wonderful researchers and scholars who work in English and philosophy.
Are you saying that humanities and the sciences can get along?
They can get along. They can get along.
They need each other, don't they?
But they need each other. But we wanted to be in the humanities more visible in order to promote that process of working together.
Absolutely. And I think Gerald Early made that point, too, that the humanities is life, that it informs so much of what we do. And we've had callers on this program in the past relate the idea that they studied the humanities, they ended up somewhere else, but their work in the humanities helped them see the world differently, help them understand things. Joan, what do you think?
Yeah, the phrase I always use is life enriching, that the studying the humanities is life enriching for everyone. And this isn't really about getting a job, as Gerald Early said, although it's not totally disconnected from the skills that employers, and I would say enlightened employers, have come to value, being able to synthesize knowledge, to have a perspective on human experience, to write well, to understand what values we bring to the problems that we're trying to solve. These are all things that the humanities try to address. But at any rate, to get back to your question about how we got where we are now, the faculty was concerned about creating a community. The administration also was very supportive. It has been continuously supportive of the idea that we should actually have a physical space, which we don't have yet, but which we're moving toward, and a concerted effort to bring together people from across the campus and really from across the country and internationally to think together, to think together about the human experience.
Yeah, let's get to the phones and get some of our listeners' experiences there. And this is Mary in Rochester. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes. I hope you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay. Well, I just want to say how important foreign language study has been for me in my personal life. And because there are texts in other languages that have revealed things to me about my background that I would not otherwise have known because they're not translated into English. I could go into detail about how crucial those texts have been. But, scholars and writers and thinkers from other cultures, Spanish-speaking, French-speaking, and so forth, published ideas, writing about ideas that are very unpopular in the United States. I'm thinking particularly about Marxism. You know, there are a lot of Spanish-speaking Marxists, and Ronald Reagan himself once quoted Marx, but he may have known more about Marx than the average American, but not because he spoke another language, because he was a politician, and Marx has been translated into English, but Marxist writings are not generally. French texts and essays and so forth.
Well, Mary, let me just jump in here and say, first of all, on the question of languages, the University of Rochester's and Open Letter Books has been doing great work. Chad Post is one of the really great guests who's on this program once in a while, and sort of helping us stay connected to the world in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think some of what Mary is telling us there is, sort of connected to that idea that languages connect us and will help reveal things that we might not know, whether it's about ourselves, as she said, or just understanding other cultures and literatures and the values there. What do you think of that, Joe?
Well, I'm actually by training an Americanist. I study American history, but I study American cultural history, and I'm very sympathetic to the caller's view that really to understand another culture, one needs to explore language.
You teach on the history of the book, is that right?
I have written and taught about the history, in particular, of reading practices. I did a book a few years ago about how Americans read poetry in school and in the family. I'm thinking here of the late 19th and mostly first half of the 20th century, the school recitation, for example. And that was a fascinating subject for me. I've also been involved in a big collaborative project on the history of the book in America. And that's actually relevant to the Humanities Center because the idea of collaboration is something that we want to promote. You think of the humanities scholar sitting alone in a little library carrel or in a dusty attic working away, and some of the work that we do has to be like that. But it's also possible to crawl out. And,
yes.
And in fact, useful and beneficial to one's work to crawl out and to talk to other people. So that's what the center, in part, is going to do.
You've talked about the history of the book in this country. Are you concerned about the future of
Oh, I get that question, and I usually retreat to the view that I'm a historian and I don't predict the future. But I did co-edit for this History of the Book project the volume that dealt with the period from 1945 to sort of the present. And we had the temerity to call our volume The Enduring Book. So that tells you that I do think the book is not just going to disappear. Just as Gerald Early said, the humanities are not going to disappear.
Yeah, every time we get that pronouncement, it is greatly exaggerated, thankfully. John in Rochester's next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s in Buffalo, and I saw a lot of racism back then, no doubt about it. But I would like to ask your guest, what really bothers me about the Black Lives Matter movement and the disappointment I have from that movement and the African-American community is they use Michael Brown as an icon. And the guy was, I think that's the wrong choice. I think it's alienating a lot of people in the white American community because the guy was a thug and committed crimes that was on tape just before this incident.
All right, John, let me just jump in on a couple of points. Stay on the line because I want to. I just want to remind our listeners that John is responding to questions and comments we've had about the Black Lives Matter movement earlier this hour with Gerald Early, cultural critic who is coming to the University of Rochester on Thursday. He was only available for the first half hour, and I certainly don't want to speak for Gerald Early, but 5 p.m. on Thursday at the Hawkins Carlson's room at Rush Reese Library is a great place to continue that conversation. John, the point you're making about Michael Brown has been heavily debated, and I would even tell some of our listeners who might, if they might be inclined to disagree with John, no less than Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, who's probably not John's favorite columnist, who is certainly a progressive columnist. Nicholas Kristof has said that he thinks the Black Lives Matter movement chose the wrong person to make such a central part of the movement. Nicholas Kristof's point around that, and again, I'm not speaking for anyone, I'm trying to recall his writing on that, was that Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, there were other cases of much more clear cases of what looked like misconduct, whereas Nicholas Kristof was saying the early narrative on Michael Brown, even the Justice Department, couldn't find fact for the notion of hands up, don't shoot. And again, I don't want to make this an hour about Michael Brown, but that's even Nicholas Kristof is agreeing with the point that John was making, that that wasn't the right case. John, let me just tell you, and I want to get your response to this, some who even pushed back against Kristof said that even if that initial narrative was wrong, what is not wrong is the idea that Michael Brown is much more likely to be stopped by police because of his race, whether he's driving a car or walking down the street, and that makes it emblematic of some of the problems. So you know, I do understand the point you're making, and even you and Nick Kristof, who might not always agree, agreed on that one. But I think some people have pushed back, John, to say, hey, this is a country where still people like Michael Brown are going to be stopped, or Gerald Early is going to be stopped in a mall in suburban St. Louis because they're black, not because they did anything wrong. What do you
think? Well, I'll tell you, Evan, I've had the occasion, what I do for a living is I have to go into all different types of neighborhoods. And I'll tell you, when you go into a ghetto neighborhood as a white man, it's a little precarious and dangerous. And I can't tell you some of the language that's thrown at me. But so I have a feeling sometimes how the African-Americans can feel. But one of the issues, too, is most crimes, at least in the city of Rochester, are committed by African Americans, and I think that holds true throughout urban areas across the country. And that way far and above what the percentage of their what the percentage is that they equate to our population is. So you know, I think that's an issue too that has to be dealt with. And I think the stop and frisk policy in New York City was a good one, and I think maybe we should do that here. But you know, it's a tough problem.
John, I appreciate the call, and I wish Gerald Early were still with us to respond. But I would say Thursday, 5 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library is a great place to continue that conversation, because Early is going to be talking about race in neighborhoods, his work in Philadelphia, for example, and you heard him talk about some of the way that work translates. So I wouldn't deign to speak on Professor Early's behalf there. I think probably Joan Rubin feels the same way.
I wouldn't deign to speak on his behalf either, although I would say that studying American history is a useful way to get some perspective on these issues.
All right, back to the phones and Jenna in Pittsford. Go ahead, Jenna.
One of my concerns, Evan, is going back to your original caller, and is the issue of complex racial diversity. I know that I've gotten heat from some of your callers about being white and in Pittsburgh, yet they fail to realize that my nieces and nephews are black and Muslim, and one of my nephews is black but has two white parents in a suburb in the southern tier where he's the only black student in his high school, and it was a high school where they had a black face issue, Waverly High School. And so when you talk about this whole issue of white privilege, what does that mean when you have that issue of racial diversity? How do we talk about that fairly?
Yeah, I don't have an easy answer. I think it's a fair point.
My niece's my niece and nephew, for instance, who live in D.C., their father is the son of a Somali diplomat, and he came over, and when he came over, the Somali government fell. So his father had to go from being a Somali diplomat to a taxi cab driver and raise 8 children in a one-bedroom apartment in Washington, D.C. So they knew being poor. They knew about prejudice. They knew what all that is, but they all grew up to be, and I'm sure I'm going to get slammed for, you know, the defense of this, but they all grew up to have PhDs, be teachers, be lawyers, et cetera. He was an AUSA, et cetera, and they grew out of that. So what is the issue? Is it prejudice?
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that, but you said some of your nephews and nieces are Muslim, Jenna?
Yeah, they're from Somalia, so they're Muslim.
Yeah, and you know, again, we're at a place in this country
and
where...
And we're Irish Catholics. So yeah, Irish Catholics,
you've got quite the gamut, you know, but we're at a place in this country where in the last week we've been talking about a leading presidential candidate saying that, you know, we should have essentially a religious litmus test for the White House, and that your nieces and nephews' religion makes them go directly against the American Constitution.
Correct.
You know, it is a very strange sort of time.
And your next topic about the Texas student, I mean, my brother is a retired Army major and in Texas right now, and he's married to a woman from the Philippines, and their son, his skin is brown. And the reality is they're in Texas. And when there are issues that come up, there's always a concern. Is he being treated as an American student, or is he being treated as a student with brown skin who speaks with an accent because he speaks multiple languages?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well,
and those are very real issues in our country.
Jenna, thank you. And I mean, you're right. And I wish that Gerald Early were still with us to kind of talk about that. But we only have a few minutes left. And so let me ask Joan Rubin, who is the interim director of the New Humanities Center at the University of Rochester. You've got Gerald Early on Thursday, but you've got big plans for the center.
Yes.
And that probably means other people coming in and events, et cetera. So why don't you kind of lay out for us a map of what you're trying to do, who you have coming in, et cetera.
Okay. So we are very committed to serving three populations. One, of course, is our faculty and helping people to have that kind of community that I was talking about earlier. We also want to do something for our undergraduate students, and we may be creating programs or courses that will help to run or support in the academic year. But the third thing that I really wanted to stress with your listeners is that we want to reach out to the Rochester community. And we already have had a wonderful opportunity to do that because the director of the Rochester Oratorio Society, Eric Townell, came to us. He read about our founding. This is exactly the kind of thing that we'd love to see happen more and more. He read about our founding. He said the Oratorio Society was performing Mendelssohn's Elijah at the end of October, October 30th. Could we do some supportive programming around this concert? And we leapt at this opportunity. We are collaborating. There are going to be 4 programs, 3 on the U of R campus, all about Mendelssohn in historical context, in cultural context. We're bringing in the foremost biographer of Mendelssohn on October 29th to talk about Mendelssohn as a prodigy. So especially for the classical music lovers who are in the audience, I urge you to attend these events, and you can get more information about them on our website. I'm just going to give you that address, but you can also find us through Google. But the address is www.rochester.edu/college/humanities. And that will bring up the schedule of all these Mendelssohn events. Then this lecture series that Gerald Early is kicking off for us is going to continue throughout the year. We have a wonderful speaker, the director of the Stanford University Humanities Center, Carolyn Winterer, who's coming in November to answer the question, was there an American Enlightenment, that philosophical movement that we associate with Europe, but we also associate maybe with Ben Franklin, those of us who remember our early American history. She's written a new book that will be out next year, questioning the whole concept of whether there was an American Enlightenment. And we'll have two more speakers in that series in the spring. So lots of things for the public to attend, and we really look forward to seeing everyone.
Well, you're a historian, Joan. Was there an American Enlightenment?
Well, I'm a historian of the late 19th and early 20th century, so I get to slide out of that question also.
You have all the artful dodges here.
Yes, I do. I don't know, because I haven't read this work, but I suspect that the answer is going to be that this was a transnational movement, because the historians who are working today on these kinds of questions look across the Atlantic and go back and forth a lot.
Okay, 20-second answer then, because we're almost out of time. If the Humanities Center is successful, what changes? What do you add to the community?
We have a richer resource for understanding, as Gerald Early said, if I may quote his wonderful formulation, how human beings make meaning.
Well said. And our thanks to Gerald Early for his time. You can see him Thursday, 5 p.m., it's a free public lecture at the Hawkins Carlson Room at the Rush Reese Library. Free parking as well, is that
free
right?
Free parking,
there?
A reception, very nice. Do come.
Okay, that's 5 p.m. and open to the public. And you can continue that conversation with Gerald and hear more about what he has to say. Thank you, Joan, for taking the time to talk about the humanities and some of these complex issues that we see this hour. The humanities really is tied in to all of these conversations about what's going on in this country. Thank you, Joan.
Thanks very much, Evan.
And thanks to Balabanka, the engineer of this program. Thank you to you for listening. I'm Evan Dawson, and this has been Connections on member-supported public radio.